food adverts.
My friends, my family think I'm obsessed with this.
I mean, they're right, I am.
I mean, look at this. So this is what we're walking through is the food environment. We could be anywhere in the UK. It's all industrially processed food. It's extremely convenient. It's very cheap. And it's so appealing. And yet, we know that this food environment is driving a catastrophe. The evidence is increasingly clear that pre-prepared, packaged, highly processed food is linked to weight gain, obesity, some cancers, dementia, type 2 diabetes, and early death from all causes. We're in the middle of a food crisis, but we can't stop eating. And if you want to understand why, you have to go and speak to people who have worked inside the food industry.
We've worked with Heinz, Cadbury's, Pringles.
No, it's custard.
Campbell's Soup.
Unilever.
PepsiCo.
Kellogg.
Dr. Pepper.
These foods are engineered to be addictive.
How have we sleepwalked into this situation? What is the food we eat today doing to our minds? And how has it become so irresistible?
Irresistible. Why we can't stop eating.
Will be left a sick and impoverished nation, according to former government food czar, if we don't do something about our junk food habit.
My name's Chris Van Tulleken. I'm an NHS doctor, I'm a scientist, and I'm part of a growing group of doctors and academics who are increasingly worried about the effect that the global food system is having on all of us. When it comes to obesity, the way that we've understood the problem is it's a failure of willpower. People are just making bad choices. They're somewhat lazy. It's basically their fault. This is American government data for men and women of all different ages, the different lines of different ages, for obesity. What you see is between 1960 and 1975, there's a fairly steady percentage of obesity in the population. But in the mid-1970s, obesity starts going up in all of the groups simultaneously. Now, if you're saying willpower is responsible, what you're proposing is that all of these groups of people simultaneously lost moral responsibility, and that's not plausible. Something else happened to our food in the mid-1970s to make it irresistible to people.
An elderly white man with white hair sits down and smiles.
Good afternoon. How are you?
New York, USA. Flying high over Manhattan in aerial archive footage.
My name is Howard Moskowitz. I'm an experimental psychologist. And in the 1970s, people think that I revolutionized the food industry. I'd like to talk to you about the way the science came about. You know, you read all the time in the newspapers, it's a sinister plot, generally by one or two scientists in a laboratory like Ming the Magnificent, saying, how should we make the people of the world fat? Well, let me tell you my own history. I was called by the vice chairman of Campbell Soup, and they said to me, we're competing against a company which manufactures ragu. They used to make it out of contadina tomato paste and water like my mother did in the 50s. I said, I think you can make a better pasta sauce. And they said, how? And I said, let's figure out the actual food ingredients that you can blend, and let's make different combinations, and we'll test them. And we ended up creating 45 dishes. And we got people to taste them and rate how much they liked them. I realized very simply that if you systematically varied the ingredients and you tested them, nature would reveal itself in stunning clarity. So this is the origin of the bliss point with which I am identified. The easiest way to demonstrate a bliss point is add sugar to coffee. As you add more and more sugar, you like it more and more up to a certain point, and then you like it less and less. The highest level is where you like it most. That's the bliss point. Where you have the bliss. And that became the basis of a multi-billion dollar 30-year run.
A receipt is ripped from a till.
I found that I could consult with companies like Unilever, Pepsi Cola, Tropicana Dr. Pepper, and Spam.
Cans of Spam on a conveyor belt.
Sales almost always go up because you're making a delicious product and you know that people love it. Very simple. But over the years, products became more complicated and more artificial.
Archive footage of food being processed. First circular biscuits, then loaves of bread.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Chris is typing on a laptop.
From the 1970s, food companies started to realize that if they used proper scientific development processes, they could sell us a lot more food.
Former executive of Kraft General Foods from 1972 to 2008.
My name's John Ruff, and I've spent 40 years in the food industry across 7 different countries. Companies spend a lot of time optimizing all aspects of their product, the flavor, the taste, the texture. People want their product to be as good, if not better, than the competitor, so it will sell more. In research and development, we used to use a phrase called the funnel. And the funnel was the product development funnel. You need 100 products to be in what's called advanced development. You need 1,000 in early development. You need 10,000 ideas. Often those ideas don't get off the drawing board, don't get off the paper. Or they'll make some early prototypes and mock-ups.
OK, seats numbers 1 to 14, you'll be now testing the fidget gems.
We use trained sensory panels to give us ratings. Is it squishy? Is it hard? Is it soft? Is it crunchy? And that's very much how the food industry operates. The food company really almost has to sort of provide products that consumers want, otherwise they will go out of business.
I've spoken to lots of people who work at food companies, and they've told me about these tasting panels. Two of the most important things that are measured are how quickly do people eat and how much of the food do people eat, because that's what drives sales. But these tasting panels have a subjective element, so some companies started taking it much further.
From the Shard towering over central London to a woman having a brain scan, Professor Frances McGlone, lead neuroscientist at Unilever from 1994 to 2009.
One of my remits when I first joined the company was the way that they would get information, and that would be always word of mouth. It would be focus groups, it would be questionnaires, and I just railed against that stuff. I'm a neuroscientist. I introduce brain scanning to Unilever. I'm not interested in talking to a consumer. I want to find out what they like by digging deeper, because we're not really aware of why we like what we like. And one way to get that is with the neuroimaging capabilities. What we would do is basically lie someone in a brain scanner and feed food into the mouth, and we looked at the activity that was coming into that brain.
So one study that we did was feeding people in one of these brain scanners different types of ice cream. And what we found is that this area right at the front of the brain here is called the orbitofrontal cortex, and it's a reward system area. And it was glowing like a furnace.
You're looking at what the brain is telling you. You can't fudge it. And it's grown and grown and grown as a way to predict what product is going to be successful and what isn't.
A machine fills a line of cones with ice cream.
And the ice cream business used that brain imaging data to basically make the claim that ice cream makes you happy. And this is the article that was in the newspapers.
Slightly unfortunate, it's got an obesity thing.
Yes. Just his contrast, isn't it? Yeah. You can edit that out, can't you?
A headline. Ice cream warms up the pleasure centres of the brain.
The brain scans predicted which foods people would like or which ones they'd love, but they also helped to show something about those foods that would be really crucial for the food industry. If you want to sell a lot of food, texture is massively important.
One thing many people don't realise is that factory processing changes the textural properties of that food. Now, that makes the food much softer. And an interesting fact about soft food is you're not chewing it as much. That actually short-circuits the normal satiety mechanisms that you would have if you were actually chewing food properly. So a food which you had to actually put some work into chewing, so a crunchy carrot, is having that benefit in terms of the fact you're spending a lot more time chewing it. With a soft food, you don't do that. So you're bypassing a normal mechanism that tells you you're full. Once you've worked out that playing around with the texture of a food, making it softer, tricks that normal satiety or fullness mechanism, clearly there's an opportunity there for some kind of scurrilous behaviour in making food softer so that people will eat more and therefore you sell more of your product. So there is an opportunity there, of course, you know, to basically not do the right thing, should I say.
Serving up lasagna from a foiled tray.
So much of the packaged food that we eat is incredibly soft.
Chris opens a bag of corn puff snacks.
My kids love these.
You don't typically think of this as being a soft food because it's a bit crunchy, but actually after that initial crunch, you can just crush it with your tongue, right? It's got no resistance at all. But in terms of the calories per gram, it's got way more calories than even a very fatty burger. So the softness and the energy density mean that you consume it incredibly quickly. And there's a food industry term for these very light, puffy foods that melt in the mouth. It's called vanishing caloric density.
He eats one.
Gone.
A Cornish pasty rotating.
The thing that makes us eat a lot isn't just what we do to the food. It's also about logos, marketing, branding, the box the food comes in.
A sign reads, "Do not enter when red light is on."
Here we've got a very crinkly packet of crisps. The noise is quite loud. Extraordinary. Of course, that's going to make you think fresh, fresh, fresh. I'm Professor Barry Smith. I work on sensory science with neuroscientists and psychologists. Pringles are often irresistible. It's in their slogan.
Potato crisps in a tube, pop it up and get in the mood.
Once you pop, you can't stop.
When I worked for Pringles, they were really worried about the competition from Doritos, and they were trying to think of ways to innovate. And one idea was, let's make the tube bigger so that we can get our whole hand in there. And I said, no, don't do that. People like struggling to get their hand in. They're like foraging bears. They're trying to extract the food. And that searching out something to eat, that's increasing your desire. Eating is a multi-sensory experience. There's the look of the food, there's the smell of the food, there's the feeling of the food on your fingers. Even the sound of food matters. When you open a fizzy soda, you've got two noises. You've got the click and the tear. Sound engineers and manufacturers work really hard to get that sound just right, and that's sonic branding.
The expression of a brand through signature sounds.
Many companies have asked me to work on sonic branding for them. And I think I can mention when I was working with Kellogg, they said, "Ooh, what's sonic branding?" And I said, "You invented this." Most people will remember as children the experience of lifting a bowl to their ear. And what are they listening for? Snap, crackle, and pop. That's Sonic branding at its best, and that's the original.
It's fun to put Snap Crackle Pop into your morning.
Shelves in an off-license, stocked with different food products. The packaging is colourful and enticing.
Look at all this. The food companies are using branding to grab our attention. It's salt, fat, sugar wrapped up in appealing packages. We've got cartoon characters. There are tigers, there are monkeys, there are bright colours everywhere. But to sell even more food, industry had to change the culture of how we eat, the number of times a day we eat, and this is called snackification.
Flying over the spires and rooftops of Cambridge, an Hispanic woman with dark, curly hair.
I am Dr. Janaína Chávez Ugalde. I am currently a research associate at the University of Cambridge. I trained as a food engineer in Mexico, and I worked for Cargill. It's a company that makes most of the raw ingredients that go into processed foods. Name it flour, sugar, oil, high fructose corn syrup, cocoa.
A greengrocer's in Mexico.
In the last several years, I started to see an influx of packaged products from the USA into Mexico. I started to see my peers getting bigger. I started to hear about diseases like type 2 diabetes, cancer in younger people. I started to ask questions about what is our impact as a food company in the health of our nation. And that's why I changed careers. There's a lot of competition out there, and food companies make their money by the amount of products we consume from them. So there's a stomach share that they're fighting for. And there are hours in the day in between breakfast, lunch, and dinner. What happens between those hours? They want us to snack. You wake up, and this is what you have. Snack number one, breakfast shake, ultra processed. This is heavily marketed for you to have on the go. Do not sit down. Do not take time to crunch through something. Snack number two of the day. It's empty calories. Energy dense, nutrient poor. Midday, you're starting to get a little bit peckish, and what do you have? Veggie straws. This is a good example of a health claim snacking product. Whereas before, we would have had food, actual food. Now we are marketed into believing that this is actually a healthy replacement. Some snacking products have now been made to be linked with being physically active. So after the gym, I have a high-protein, low-sugar bar instead of having a healthier option. You finish having dinner and you have these snacks that are sold to you as more to share, where in fact you can just finish them watching the TV by yourself. I do like them. I cannot stop eating them. And I literally can't. Oh, God.
Chris reads the ingredients on a large bag of crisps.
If you're a food company, there are two main ways you can make more money. You can sell more food, so you can grab more stomach share, or you can use cheaper ingredients.
Greater Manchester. A middle-aged woman with brown shoulder-length hair scratches under her nose while waiting to be interviewed.
I'm Susie Glasky, and I used to work for the food industry for nearly 20 years. And now I really want to lift the lid on how food industry marketing is robbing us of our health. The first time I really started to feel differently about the food industry was when Sunny Delight came out. Sunny Delight, the taste. It was sold as great for all the family.
Any more?
Coming right up.
Thanks, Mum. So when can we move in then?
On your bike.
And when I looked at the ingredients, I realised this was a really cheap product which had been dressed up to be something healthy. And I think that's where I drew the line. So the main thing that I worked on were modified starches, and these were really, really clever. They can make snack foods crunchy and crispy, and they can make yogurts creamy and smoothies glossy. When we eat starch in a whole food, it's digested slowly. But if that same starch is highly processed, then it's broken down very quickly by the body and it spikes our blood sugar, and that then leads to a whole host of health problems and also to our body storing fat. One of the starches that I worked on, you could add it to a jam, for example, and it would give the sensory experience of having a strawberry without it actually being a strawberry. Fruit is expensive, it's difficult to handle, it spoils quickly, it's expensive to transport. So it's kind of padding out products with stuff that's just cheap, but which mimics the real stuff.
From food jars moving slowly along a conveyor belt to a London Overground train passing over a railway bridge. Fulham, London. Brant Mabry from food development agency Tastehead.
We develop food and beverage products for companies of all sizes. So we've worked with Heinz, Cadbury's, Pringles, Green and Black's Chocolate. Cost is such a big focus when we're developing products. From the ingredients, the manufacturing, the shipping, and then from distributors to retailers, everybody wants to make a profit, they want to make a margin.
Here are the ingredients that you need to make a homemade lemon cake. We've got lemons, unsurprisingly, flour, sugar, butter, eggs, some bicarbonate soda, and some salt.
But if you're going to make in a factory, we've got quite a few things that we need to consider. And so I have here a slightly longer list of ingredients
double
that you might see in a cake from
yeah.
a supermarket. One of the main considerations has to be the shelf life.
Of course, yeah.
Because your lovely homemade recipe, you're talking days.
Exactly.
Before it starts to go mouldy and just frankly stale.
Yeah.
Whereas something in the supermarket is going to need months of shelf life.
Exactly.
You'll see here we've got potassium sorbate as one of the preservatives, and that is to inhibit the growth of mould and yeasts so that your cake doesn't go off. It's quite bitter, a bit like biting on a paracetamol or something. And so some of the ways that you might mask some of these bitter tastes might be with the flavouring, for yeah. one, the salt. And then something else that you can't ignore with an ingredient list like this is how much cheaper it will be.
Production cost. Industrial cake, 23p, 30 days. Homemade cake, £4.86, 4 days.
Across the board, we're substituting rich ingredients like eggs and butter with cheaper ones, but also some of the ingredients from the stabilisers and the starches.
Yep.
It's all allowing you to use cheaper ingredients.
Red London buses drive past outside University College Hospital. Chris walks up to a reception desk and talks to two women behind it.
If you sit in my clinic, if you work in this hospital, you see the toll that diet-related disease takes on our patients.
Chris is walking through a corridor.
There's incredibly strong evidence that the cause of the pandemic of obesity and diet-related disease that's sweeping the globe is industrially processed packaged foods.
Looking out through a window as an ambulance drives by. Packaged food products moving through machines. In his home, Chris is sitting at a table.
Previously, describing these goods was really hard scientifically. We called it junk food or fast food. And then a little while ago, a friend gave me this paper. It's published in an obscure Brazilian public health journal. It says, a new classification of foods based on the extent and purpose of their processing. Not an appealing read, so I ignored it, left it on the desk for weeks. But I eventually got around to reading it. And I thought, if it's true, this might be the most important scientific paper published so far this century.
The paper's titled, A New Classification of Foods Based on the Extent and Purpose of Their Processing. A bustling street market in Sao Paulo, Brazil. At the University of Sao Paulo, An older man with glasses and grey wavy hair is looking through some papers laid out on his desk.
My name is Carlos Montero. My research is about nutrition-related health problems. Our first motivation was to study causes of the increasing obesity rates in Brazil. We started by studying changes in diets. And then we realized that the main change in the food bought in Brazil was a huge decline in cooking oils, sugar, and salt. So this was a sort of surprise, because usually these foods are considered unhealthy and cause weight gain. According to nutrition science, cooking oils would be terrible, right? Because cooking oil is 100% fat. But nobody consumes cooking oil by itself. People use cooking oils at home to cook. And we realized that these were being replaced by instant noodles, frozen meals, cookies, desserts. People were eating more industrial foods than home-prepared food. That was the main change. We confirmed that the more people eat industry-prepared food instead of home-prepared food, the higher the risk of obesity.
Carlos is on a computer.
Then we decided that a new food classification would be necessary. We named it ultra-processed food.
The term is highlighted on Carlos's paper. Back in London, Chris turns a page while looking through it.
Carlos Montero was proposing something really radical. Previously, we'd focused on sugar, saturated fat, and salt as being the problem. And he said, well, maybe it's the industrial processing that is making us all eat a lot of these and having maybe other effects as well. We've been doing food processing for thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of years without significant health problems, where we take whole food and we smoke it, we salt it, we preserve it, we ferment it. It's essential for human life. Ultra-processed food is entirely different. And the full definition is very long, but if you're wondering if something you're eating is ultra-processed, look at the ingredients list, and if you see things that you wouldn't expect to find in a home kitchen, then it's probably an ultra-processed food. When I first read this paper, it seemed really important, but I had some doubts. And I wasn't the only one. Lots of people were very sceptical about it.
Maryland, USA. A white man with silver hair walks up to a computer and looks at a graph on the screen.
My name's Dr. Kevin Hall. I'm a senior investigator here at the National Institute of Health. I first heard about this idea of ultra-processed foods, which basically says that nutrients aren't important at all. It's really about the extent and purpose of processing. And it seemed a little crazy to me because we have a whole history of nutrition science focusing on nutrients. And then along comes Carlos and says, you know, you've been focusing on the wrong thing for the past several decades. So we enlisted the help of our dietitians here at the NIH Clinical Center, and I gave them what I thought was maybe an impossible task. Can you design two diets? In one case, all of the foods come from minimally processed foods. And alternatively, an ultra-processed diet that is matched for the salt, the sugar, the fat, the fiber.
A jam sandwich, a hot dog, and chicken nuggets.
And the idea of the study was to bring 20 men and women into the clinical center where they would live with us for a month.
So you have an hour to finish it, or less.
We take complete control over their food environment and present them with meals and very simple instructions. Just eat as much or as little as you'd like. And what they didn't know was that at the end of each of the meals, we were measuring their leftovers.
He ate most of the tater tots.
The dietitians downstairs will actually weigh it back and we'll know the exact quantity that's left over.
We were measuring their weights every day. We were measuring how many calories their bodies were burning, their oxygen consumption, their carbon dioxide production. My hypothesis going in was that we would see very, very little difference in the number of calories people ate. And of course, I was wrong. It turned out that the people, when they were on the ultra-processed diet, they spontaneously overate calories, about 500 calories per day, greater than when they were on the minimally processed diet. What we discovered was that the ultra-processed foods, despite being matched for their nutrient composition, they tended to have many more calories per bite. Another thing that we found was that we ended up preparing and presenting people with foods that were high in sugar and fat. That's something that's very rare to see in a food in nature. These are so-called hyperpalatable foods. And we ended up presenting people with more of those hyperpalatable foods on the ultra-processed diet.
A plate of macaroni and cheese. Chris is sitting in front of his open laptop.
At the time it was published, Kevin Hall's experiment was so important because it was really good quality evidence that ultra-processed food does make you eat too much of it. Now it's just one scientific paper in a huge and rapidly growing body of evidence. I think one of the biggest problems with this kind of food is that so many of us struggle to stop eating it.
Zurich, Switzerland. A white woman with long ginger hair steps up on stage in a black and white polka dot dress. She takes her place behind the podium.
Hi, everyone. I'm so thrilled to be here today to speak with you on my research that looks at parallels between addictive substances and ultra-processed food.
I'm Dr. Ashley Gerhart. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and the director of the Food and Addiction Science and Treatment Lab. Both fat and sugar are converging on the same neural reward center. So it really seems to be hyperpalatable food products that kind of mimic the reward profile that we see with addictive drugs. When we look at the sorts of foods that trigger those key diagnostic indicators of addiction, it's really clear what it's not. It's not minimally processed foods like fruits or vegetables or beans or lean meats like chicken breast. It's really processed foods that deliver high doses of refined carbohydrates like sugars and starches, typically alongside high levels of fat. It's chocolate, it's ice cream, it's pizza. It's foods that don't exist in nature. One of the first things that we did was try and understand how do we identify someone who might actually be experiencing an addiction. So we created the Yale Food Addiction Scale, which is the major tool used to measure an addiction to ultra-processed food. We really looked at the diagnostic criteria that we use to diagnose somebody with an alcohol addiction, a tobacco addiction, asking people about their experiences of losing control over their intake, really intense cravings, continuing to use even though you're having really negative consequences.
When I started to eat certain foods, I ate much more than planned. Yes, every day.
I'm Sarita, I'm 48 years old,
and I'm a food addict.
Sarita Drinkle, youth worker and fitness coach.
Processed food has this control over me. I don't want to binge on a bowl of broccoli. It's the crap food. There's something in it, and I've struggled with drug and alcohol addiction, and the parallels are too similar for there not to be a link.
Waves roll towards an empty beach.
Most people in my position binge in the evenings. I will start with cereal, and it's always really sweet cereal, so this is a good one. I would pour as much of that into a mixing bowl, not a normal bowl, a mixing bowl, and start with that. You are talking a box of cereal and three or four huge bars of chocolates and a couple of packets of biscuits, way more food than you'd think a person could eat. Then after that, it's just about how quickly can I purge it? By purging, I mean making myself sick. I'm an intelligent person. I'm a fitness fanatic. I know that my binging behaviour is really bad for me and could end in heart attacks and diabetes and all sorts of stuff. That's why I know it's an addiction, because I don't seem to care. I don't care.
So I wanted to give you a little bit of a sense of the people who've come into our lab. This individual had severe food addiction, and they said, I can't even be in the same room as any type of donuts, because I will finish a dozen all by myself. And I'm a type 2.
The potency and the reward power of these ultra-processed foods can trigger an addictive response that leads them to consume these in such a compulsive way that even if they want to cut down, even if they know it's killing them, they find they can't stop.
We have to eat to live. So giving up drugs, you quit completely and that's it. But how do you stop eating? Processed food, it's everywhere you go.
Chris is sitting at his desk at University College Hospital.
Food addiction is a growing field of study. There are lots of people who have well-founded concerns about demonising an entire category of food, and I understand that. But personally, I find it really hard to disagree with the testimony of many of my patients who feel that they are addicted to these products.
Someone bites into a slice of cake.
You have to make products taste palatable. But what's happened is that palatability has been turned into, well, it's too good, it's addictive, it's too tasty.
I mean, is there a point at which you can make a food taste good enough that people will eat it, but not too good that it's going to be called hyperpalatable? Yeah, but you know what? If somebody makes the hyperpalatable one, they'll stop eating the other one anyway.
We have to make products that taste good. People want that. We're not going to mandate that everybody's got to make their food taste bad. I don't think. It's not a world I want to be in.
Thick fog drifting over the Golden Gate Bridge.
We have a growing body of evidence that for some people, this food is addictive. And that makes me think about the tobacco industry.
San Francisco, USA. A woman sits down for an interview.
Laura Schmidt. I'm a professor at UC San Francisco in the School of Medicine. I'd been working on ultra-processed foods for a while, and one of my colleagues said, hey, you know, I've been poking around in the tobacco archive, and I know you're interested in food. You might want to check these out. And it turns out that there were hundreds of thousands of documents in the tobacco archive about food companies. From the 1960s, R.J. Reynolds, the tobacco company, starts buying up food subsidiaries. Why would a giant tobacco company buy up a food company? And the answer was something we did not expect. The people in the tobacco companies had a bunch of artificial colors and flavors developed in their labs that they were making to add to cigarettes. Flavors and colors like menthol. Their labs are developing them to put into cigarettes and create different products to target new consumers. They call them line extensions.
You've come a long way, baby, to get where you've got to today.
Virginia Slims for women who want to get thin. Marlboro for men who are couch potatoes, but actually want to be cowboys.
Listen while I tell you a story, the tale of the Marlboro brand.
They were targeting children.
An old cigarette advert with a cartoon Desi Arnaz playing guitar.
Joe Camel was a cartoon mascot that R.J. Reynolds put on Camel cigarettes because they really wanted to make kids know the brand so that when they became cigarette consumers, they would smoke Camels.
One survey found 6-year-olds in the U.S. as familiar with Joe the Camel as with Mickey Mouse.
The tobacco industry had cultivated this strategy of taking a single, utterly boring product and making it come alive with colors, flavors, branding, marketing, cartoon mascots to target different consumer markets. And we found this memo. And this memo was written in 1962 by the guy who ran the labs to the CEO of R.G. Reynolds. And he literally says here, it's easy to characterize R.J. Reynolds merely as a tobacco company. In a broader and much less restricting sense, however, R.J. Reynolds is in the flavor business. And here, he's talking about a merger with a company called Pacific Hawaiian Products Company. And they only make one thing, and that's Hawaiian Punch. Hawaiian Punch was one flavor and one color. It was bright red, and it was being marketed to adults. And within a couple of years, they had transformed this product into a children's beverage.
Hey, how about a nice Hawaiian Punch?
Sure.
What gives Hawaiian Punch its punch? It's punch.
They intuitively understood that getting the kid hooked was the goal, because that kid is going to be a lifelong consumer. What's so brilliant about the marketing strategy is you can take that tobacco model and apply it to the food industry. You can make massive numbers of line extensions.
Wasn't that a refreshing commercial?
Very sophisticated advertising campaigns that allow you to kind of get inside the minds of consumers and make them want what you have to sell. We know that people in food companies were putting people in a brain scan to observe what goes on in the brain when people are exposed to the food products that they were developing. Whether or not they intended to make all of these foods addictive, I don't know. What we can say is that if you're eating a brand that was ever owned by a tobacco company, there's a stronger likelihood that it has been developed to make you want more.
Two ambulances parked outside University College Hospital. Chris is sitting at his desk, typing on a computer.
The biggest cigarette companies in the world were also the biggest food companies. They were the same companies. And of course, over decades, the tobacco industry perfected the techniques for denying that any of their products were addictive.
Virginia, USA. The senior vice president of Philip Morris from 1992 to 2008.
Hi, I'm Steve Parrish. Today, we're going to set the record straight. Cigarettes neither alter a person's mood, nor do they impair an individual's ability to function. Those people who term smoking an addiction do so for political and ideological, not scientific reasons.
Steve, in the present.
I retired in 2008 from Altria Group, Inc., formerly known as Philip Morris, the tobacco company, where I was a senior vice president of corporate affairs. In the early 1990s, there was a sea change in attitudes about the tobacco industry in the United States. And it seemed like it was the year of the perfect storm in 1994 when there were congressional hearings.
Please consider yourself to be under oath.
Members of Congress asked the CEOs of the various tobacco companies, do you believe cigarette smoking is addictive?
Do you believe nicotine is not addictive?
I believe nicotine is not addictive, yes.
Cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction.
I don't believe that nicotine or our products are addictive.
I believe nicotine is not addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
And I too believe that nicotine is not addictive.
At the end of a two-day hearing, the expert committee decided that, yes, cigarette smoking is addictive. And then a few years later, our company, Philip Morris, decided to change its position and acknowledge the fact that cigarette smoking is addictive. When our company made that announcement, it caused quite a stir, and even a bigger stir when we announced that we were in favor of the Food and Drug Administration regulating the tobacco industry. When the Philip Morris companies saw that there was a continual decline year over year over year in cigarette smoking, it just made sense for the company to look beyond tobacco. And there were similarities in the products, not in terms of the product themselves, but where they were bought and sold. Grocery stores, convenience stores, and places like that.
But there have been claims ultra-processed food can be addictive. Do you believe that's the case?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know whether specific food products would meet that definition of addiction. I would leave that to people who have studied the products and studied the science there. I don't know whether any companies would admit addiction of a particular food product, but I would hope that the companies would listen to the science and say and do the right thing.
Black and white archive footage showing people casually smoking in a cafe.
I think right now, we are, with ultra-processed food, a bit like where we were in the 60s with cigarettes. And in my opinion, the food industry is using many of the same techniques that the tobacco industry used to protect their interests. And lots of scientists have experienced this firsthand.
Yale University, Connecticut, USA. A woman is studying brain scans on a computer.
I'm Dana Small. I'm a neuroscientist. I'm interested in how the brain and the body work together to optimize behavior. Pepsi came to us and they were interested to know whether they could reduce the amount of sugar in beverages to make healthier drinks. Now, to keep the calories down, you might add some artificial sweeteners to increase the sweetness but without getting the calories. So we designed this study where we had five different beverages and they had different amounts of calories, but we wanted them to be similarly sweet. So we used sweetener, which doesn't have any calories. Yeah, this is not very elegant, but in she goes. She'll actually be in there receiving little tastes of the different flavors, then swallowing and then waiting for the next flavor to come. When you look at brain responses to these different flavors, you can see the dopamine and reward systems, and what we found was completely unanticipated. We actually didn't see a negative impact of just drinking like a diet drink. But when we had a diet drink and we added calories, that's when we saw changes. So for example, it's okay to have your diet soda by itself. But if you have the diet soda with French fries, you're gonna have artificial sweeteners and carbohydrates, and that's when you're gonna get into trouble.
There's a lot we don't understand about sweeteners, but in very simple terms, if you put sweet taste on the tongue, it signals to your body that sugar is on the way. And if sugar doesn't then arrive, that seems to have several unexpected effects on the body, and it may even lead to weight gain.
If the effect we've observed generalizes, then it follows that consuming diet food can actually lead to weight gain rather than weight loss. Now, that needs to be tested experimentally, but the logic is straightforward to that prediction. We were discovering something pretty important, and rather than being able to continue with us, PepsiCo dropped us.
The woman who had a brain scan has a plastic sheet put over her.
We're experimenting, we're trying to figure things out, but during this process, you could discover something that is harmful. So that leaves them vulnerable to lawsuits. Which is exactly what happened in the tobacco industry.
Paris, France. Researcher at INSERM, Dr. Melissa Mialon.
The industry wants less regulation on their products, so the lobbying is very, very aggressive in all of our countries. Yeah.
Melissa sits down on a chair.
I was a food engineer, but I couldn't agree with the type of things that I was learning. I couldn't agree with the ingredients that we would put in the food. And now I want to expose that to people and explain what the industry is doing and why it's doing it.
What our research has shown is that the industry is fighting against the concept that ultra-processing is harming our health.
They are trying to also develop their own scientific studies and create a parallel world of publications.
National surveys fail to show any link between body mass index and consumption of ultra-processed foods.
It's becoming difficult to know what is true because those publications are basically funded by the industry.
Melissa Mialon found that out of 38 papers questioning the science around ultra-processed food, 33 of them had authors with connections to the food industry. So the food industry exerts its influence in a lot of subtle ways, and I've had personal experience of some of these.
The companies have been very, very keen to get in touch with me, to invite me to give talks and presentations, to fly across the Atlantic. Most of the time I say no. In one instance, I thought, well, let me get the contract and see how all this looks.
Is this a really well-known food company then?
So this is one of the big... Yeah, this is a big food company. So I got a contract and they offered me about £20,000 for a two-hour meeting. And I cannot understand why they want to pay me. So I got a lawyer to help me understand this. So here's the relevant bit. It says that I will not make any statement as shall disparage the food company or its products or bring the company name into disrepute.
So for about £20,000, they buy my silence on ultra-processed food.
Their most effective strategy is to fund people who sound credible, who create confusion and doubt. That is what the tobacco industry did so beautifully.
The London skyline bathed in bright golden sunshine. Chris is at University College Hospital.
The situation seems overwhelming, but there is hope. First of all, we did control tobacco. Not perfectly, but we did it. The second thing is, if you look at countries across South and Central America, they are bringing in policies that are making a difference.
Bogota, Colombia. Dr. Juan Luis Castro Cordoba, Senate of Colombia, 2018 to 2021.
My name is Juan Castro. I'm trained as a doctor. I became a senator in Colombia because I wanted to change the healthcare system.
Juan is driving along. A woman's pushing a snack trolley through a square. In the last decades, the food company saw a market that they hadn't explored, so they started to set up stores selling their products, telling people that they were very nutritious.
Chronic illnesses make up about 70 to 80% of our healthcare resources. People have doubled their weight in the last decade.
Diabetes, obesity in general, these things are all related to ultra-processed food. One of many goals was to pass a bill, first of all, proposing warning labels, and then to tax ultra-processed foods to get more money for the healthcare system.
So I thought we need to make this happen.
I just presented the facts to consultants, and I did it to social media. I presented a bill. There was some resistance and representatives that didn't want to support the bill, but by making people aware of all these issues, it became a much easier fight. And senators have children too. How are you going to stand up in Congress in front of everyone to advocate for something that's bad for their health? It took 3 years and we had to make some compromises, but by the end of the day they supported me and they voted in favor of my bill.
And it was really gratifying. I feel really proud that I was able to contribute to that fight for the people. So people can eat better.
Back in London, Chris holds up food packaging with warning labels on.
If I look at some of these Colombian warning labels, you know, it feels quite shocking to have a warning label on these very sort of everyday products. You know, you might pause if there was a big black octagon on your kid's breakfast cereal. Well, the food industry say, oh, the definition of ultra-processed food includes lots of healthy foods, like whole grain ultra-processed bread, fish fingers, baked beans. Now, this makes me incredibly angry. This is food that I do feed my children, okay? The fish fingers, very high in salt and fat. The baked beans, very high in salt and sugar, okay? The supermarket ultra-processed bread, even if it's got whole grains, very high in sugar and salt. So is this the worst food you can buy? Absolutely not. But is it the foundation of a healthy diet? It certainly isn't, no. And in lots of countries, all of those products would get warning labels for salt, fat, sugar.
Former executive of Kraft General Foods, John Ruff.
For years, the phrase was everything in moderation. You know, it's as true today as it was when whoever first coined it. We're faced with so many challenges in the world today, and certainly in providing a food supply. Some of the discussion that I hear, whether it be on chemicals or ultra-processed foods, seem to be designed to stop us from doing that. And I don't think that's a very smart place to be.
Different foods being processed in factory machines.
Researchers say ultra-processed foods now make up 73% of the US food supply.
Global obesity rates have doubled.
Ultra-processed food can cause harm similar to smoking.
Research from the University of Oxford highlights the enormous financial power of unhealthy, ultra-processed foods.
Imagine you're trying to cut down on ultra-processed food or avoid it altogether. For a start, it might be the only food you can afford, and that is true for millions of people. But it's everywhere. And it's engineered and then marketed by some of the smartest people on Earth to be irresistible. So if someone is watching this and they are struggling with their weight, with diet-related disease, I just want to reach out and grab them and go, this is not your fault. It is not you. It is the food.
The Food and Drink Federation declined our request for an interview but provided this statement. Food and drink manufacturers take the issue of obesity and poor diets very seriously, and we know we have a key role to play in helping people to eat balanced diets. Our members continue to invest hundreds of millions of pounds in creating healthier products for shoppers. As a result, UK shopping baskets now contain significantly less salt, sugar, and calories than they did a decade ago. Companies are also working to raise the fibre, fruit, and vegetable content of their products. It's of course up to government if they want to introduce new taxes or warning labels. However, taxes will push up the cost of food and could disincentivise ongoing investment in healthier products. We think there are more effective ways to encourage positive dietary change. On labelling, we believe the UK's traffic light system is a more positive way of nudging consumers towards healthier choices than warning labels, where global evidence suggests the longer-term impact is limited. However, we would support a labelling review, including to test whether consistent positive labelling on all healthier products would help consumers. The government's Scientific Advisory Committee on Nutrition had said there's insufficient scientific evidence on the concept of ultra-processed foods for it to be used for dietary guidance or policy making, and that further research is needed. If research comes to light that processing is a cause for concern, the food industry will act quickly to change their ingredients or processes.
For details of organisations which offer advice and support with eating disorders, go online to the BBC Action Line website.